This free podcast of Speaking of Faith is provided by American Public Media. Please support this valuable public radio service and contribute today. Go to the station listings page at speakingoffaith.org to learn more about becoming a member of your local public radio station. I'm Krista Tippett. Today, a monumental religious scholar of our time, Jaroslav Pelikan, who died last week. I interviewed him in his 80th year about the origins of Christian doctrine, in particular the creeds. Pelikan knew that creeds are difficult for modern people, and yet he insisted human beings will always need them.
It is one of the differences between Christianity and the other major world religions that Christianity has spawned many creeds, as this set shows, thousands of pages of creeds.
How many creeds have you collected?
Well, we collected very nearly 1,000 of them and cut it down to, I forget what the final box score is on that, somewhere around 200. Mm-hmm. Whereas to be Jewish is to affirm every day, if you're observant, and with your dying breath, if you can, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one," the Shema. And that's really all the creed that Israel needs. It's been possible to be Jewish now for these 3,000 or whatever years without publishing 4 volumes of creedal texts. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet.
Right.
Is enough of a creed to animate the most rapid expansion of a religion in the history of humanity. Mm-hmm. From the death of the prophet in 632 to 732 in Gaul at the Battle of Tours, Islam managed to spread from the Arabian Peninsula south and all the way across the northern coast of Africa to Gibraltar and into Spain and on into France in 100 years with this one little creed. And Christianity sprouts them at will, right and left.
So what is it about Christianity that has needed creeds?
Well, what it is about religious faith that needs creed is that religious faith in general, prayer addressed to whom it may concern, sentiment about some transcendent dimension otherwise undefined, does not have any staying power. It's okay to have that at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning when you're out with your friends somewhere. But in the darkest hours of life, you got to believe something specific. And that specification is the task of the creed. Because much as some people may not like it, to believe one thing is also to disbelieve another. Hmm. To say yes is also to say no. And clarifying what the yes is and then finding a way to say what it is we believe, and the experimentation involved in that. I've made a very good living studying the experimentation, trying how they tried on particular words for size. There are words in the Bible, important words, which didn't get into the creeds.
Like the
designation of Christ as Logos. Logos means both word and reason, as in logic. And the Gospel of John begins with the words that many people know. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And it was, in many ways, one of the most important terms in the arguments about the identity of Christ during the 3rd and 4th centuries. And yet, in the only creed that all Christians, or almost all Christians, have in common, the so-called Nicene Creed, the term doesn't appear.
And why was that?
They wanted rather to make use of terms that would clarify simultaneously the distinction between God and his son, that when I say I believe in Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. I am not saying I believe in two gods. The doctrine of the Trinity was the effort to preserve monotheism. Mm-hmm. That's the difference between Jesus and Socrates.
Say some more.
I mean, all of us are, in one sense or another, pupils of Socrates. John Stuart Mill said, humanity cannot be reminded often enough that there was once a man named Socrates. And that's right. But there are no temples built to Socrates. Nobody ever wrote the B minor mass in honor of Socrates, because he calls upon people to learn and therefore to be honest with themselves, but he does not call upon them to take up their cross and follow. Mm-hmm. And both he and Jesus died for what they believed. But Jesus died in the conscious commitment to the salvation of the world. And so wherever the message is preached and brought in whatever language it comes from, the language it comes to and the culture into which it penetrates must, at some stage of its maturation, learn to answer yet again the question, who do you say that I am? Because the you say in that question is the culture in which we live. He's not asking, who does the fourth century say that I am, when it was writing in Greek? That's important, because without that, we wouldn't be where we are. But at some point, you have to be who and what you are in the only culture in which you're ever going to live, the only century in which you're going to live and die. And in that century, you have to answer with whatever linguistic and philosophical equipment you have, you have to answer the question, who do you say that I am?
In addition to being statements of faith, the great creeds became powerful tools for expanding the political influence of Christian authorities. It was, after all, the Emperor Constantine, a new convert to Christianity, who convened the council at Nicaea, which is located in modern-day Turkey. Again, Yaroslav Pelikan.
So, at one level, the reason for the universal authority of the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed is the political and ultimately military authority it carried. And each conquest by the Roman Empire also brought the creed. Constantine's mother, St. Helen, came to Jerusalem, and it was she who found the sepulcher of Christ. Mm. And found the true cross. And in the true cross were nails, which she sent to Constantine, and he had them melted down into a bit for his war horse. Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to war. And as he marched and conquered, the creed came right with it. And so centuries later, in the great modern expansion of Christianity, during the 18th and above all the 19th century, my late colleague Kenneth Scott Lauret at Yale wrote a 7-volume history of the expansion of Christianity, and 3 of the 7 volumes are on the 19th century. Well, it's not accidental. That's also the great century of colonialism. So the religion of the white man, which brought sanitation and money economy and all the advantages and disadvantages of being modern, also brought the creeds.
Well, this is making me think that we should be banning this from modern worship.
And substituting another creed for it, or no creed. It's a plausible suggestion, and indeed, you are in the tradition of a fairly substantial group, particularly in the United States, as we celebrate the 200th anniversary of one of the greatest thinkers America produced, Ralph Waldo Emerson, for whom I have great personal affection. My mother, who was born in Serbia, learned English partly reading Emerson. I still have her copies of Emerson from her girlhood. And Emerson was a graduate of Harvard Divinity School and was a Unitarian minister. So he was quite prepared to believe that everyone should compose a creed different from the tradition. He said to the Divinity School students at Harvard in 1838, "You must be yourself a newborn bard of the Holy Spirit and sing it out." The trouble with that is you do it and then you do it a little bit more, and pretty soon you have to teach your children something. And so the best you can do is to teach them what you have, and you do that a generation or two, and all of a sudden there you have
a new creed.
A new creed. My late friend Stephen Jay Gould, who insisted with dogmatic fervor that he wasn't a believer, was a member, in addition to being a distinguished paleontologist and a terrific communicator, Steve Gould was a member of the Handel and Haydn Society in Boston. And so he sang all this ancient music. And in an interview several years ago that we were both involved in, he was asked about communication with other planets and other worlds, and how should we try to reach people who don't know our language or anything else. And he said, we should play the Bach B minor Mass and say in as many languages as we can, "This is the best we have ever done, and we would like you to hear it, and we'd like to hear the best you have ever done." And so he would want broadcast systems blaring across our solar system and beyond it with the B minor Mass, including Credo in Unum Deum.
Right. And that for you is the setting of this great creed, sure, of the church.